Next destination, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania's largest city, an industrial hub which is home to the country's main port. Upon arrival at Dar es Salaam's international airport, Tanzanian Foreign Minister Liberata Mulla Mulla warmly welcomed his Iranian counterpart.
We are delighted to have this high-level visit. And while he's here, I know His Excellency has only a few days, but we'd like him to see Tanzania and be able to visit Zanzibar and visit the capital. So we are really excited. We are also excited that he's coming with the business group. So we'll have a business forum. So we want also to thank the ambassador here for organizing this. So to you all, we say Karibu sana.
Amir Abdullayan, for his part, thanked his counterpart for hosting the top diplomat and his accompanying delegation, as well as governmental and private sector representatives.
There are lots of opportunities for developing Iran-Tanzania relations, particularly in the fields of mining and energy. Iran's top diplomat will take part in a business forum and also visit the country's top officials to explore potential for boosting bilateral cooperation. Mahdi Abbasian, Dar es Salaam.
Evidence continues to mount that France and the Eurozone are facing a long period of recession. French economic output just contracted for the first time in 18 months, with Germany's business activity plunging even deeper. The decline in output and demand has almost too many causes to list. At 6 months into the unrest in Ukraine, Europe's energy import costs have now quadrupled. The costly conflict shows no sign of easing as Brussels has abandoned diplomatic efforts with Moscow. The current drought across the continent appears to be the worst in the last 500 years, hurting crop yields, sparking wildfires, and increasing pessimism. That's helped push the euro to its lowest level in 20 years. The euro is now worth less than the United States dollar.
There are obviously many crises which are causing major problems for Europe, and many are linked to what's going on in Ukraine. However, we should not forget the supply chain problems which began with the coronavirus pandemic, nor the European sovereign debt crisis.
Despite the increase in gloom, last month the European Central Bank decided to raise interest rates for the first time in 11 years. That makes borrowing even more costly for businesses and individuals and could spark mass layoffs, bankruptcies, and home foreclosures. The U.S. has hiked interest rates faster than in Europe, while indicating that more rate increases will arrive soon. Since the Great Recession began, Western central banks have aligned their policies, though they do not move in an exact lockstep. The cost of living crisis is expected to significantly worsen this winter. However, many say a negative outlook for the world's most unstable macroeconomic bloc is more accurately described in years and not just seasons.
Inflation is something which could penalize the average person for 1, 2, or maybe even 3 years. So we are witnessing how the average French household is getting much, much poorer. Senior citizens are especially being hurt, and this will have major political consequences in France.
Analysts say a possible solution to Europe's energy crisis is to implement the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program. However, both Washington and Tel Aviv continue to hinder Europe's ability to protect its own economic interests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has highlighted the stance of the resistance front in addition to the significant achievements accomplished in the past 40 years.
One of our duties in the future is to strengthen the strategies of deterrence to protect Lebanon's people, land, state, sovereignty and dignity, and natural resources and treasures.
The most pressing matter awaiting the resistance, he said, was the issue of maritime resources.
The main and current challenge that we're facing now and the few upcoming days is the issue of gas and petrol and the demarcation of the maritime borders. I will not say anything new. We have said everything that we should say. Now we're all waiting. The Israelis are talking and threatening, but we should wait and see.
The cause of Palestine was also a very significant endeavor, which Hezbollah sees as a duty of the past, present, and future.
In the last 40 years, we always believed in Palestine and the Palestinian resistance. We were dutifully supporting it, and we declared that openly and supported it in all forms, in the media and in politics. We have always declared that we stand by the side of the Palestinian people and the holy sites.
Celebrating 40 years since it was founded as a resistance movement, Hezbollah organized a mass rally where artists used hologram technology to commemorate the movement's martyred leaders. Those attending stressed that if it weren't for the resistance, they would not be here today.
The passion they had, the religious that it was in their heart, that made them believe that they can take care of us, of our lands, of our everything. Without them, we are nothing.
The celebration included real footage of past operations during the Israeli occupation of Lebanon, the liberation of most Lebanese land in May of 2000, as well as significant images from the 2006 summer confrontation of the Israeli assaults, and finally the fight against Takfiri terrorists in the eastern border mountains.
Hezbollah says it's celebrating more than a mere date on the calendar as its establishment day. 40 years ago today, the Israeli army, backed by multinational forces, occupied the capital, Beirut. But here, a group of young men believed liberation was possible and achieved the unthinkable. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The British government is facing calls to press for the freedom of a young woman imprisoned in Saudi Arabia over her use of Twitter. Salma Al-Shahab, the 34-year-old mother of two, is a Saudi national who lived and studied in Britain before her arrest whilst visiting family inside Saudi Arabia in January 2021. Salma's original sentence was just 3 years, but earlier this month an appeals court extended her term, sentencing her to 34 years in prison, followed by a 34-year travel ban.
What's Salma's crime, you may ask? Just a series of Twitter posts and retweets, all of content critical of the Saudi regime. Her sentence is thought to be one of the longest ever doled out by the Saudi authorities against a female human rights activist inside the kingdom.
Activists and lawyers consider her lengthy jail sentence as shocking and outrageous, even by Saudi standards of justice. An opposition Labour MP, Hilary Benn, confirmed via a Twitter post he has sent a letter to Foreign Secretary and Tory leadership hopeful Liz Truss, demanding her intervention to help free the jailed student. As earlier this year, Truss declined to criticise the kingdom for its poor human rights record, saying Riyadh is an important partner of the UK. Critics express concern over not only Saudi rights abuses, but Western countries' double standards too.
I don't think the UK has that much influence at all if Liz Truss is going to try her hand. Of course, what we are seeing is the usual Western double standards. Only a few days before this horrific prison sentence was issued, Joe Biden was standing up for Salman Rushdie and saying that he had a right to free speech, and this was very much part of American values. But obviously those American values don't extend to Salma al-Shahab.
Ever since Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has become even more intolerant of any internal criticism and activism, jailing activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others for their political activism. International condemnation has done little to stop Saudi's behaviour, including the brutal killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul in 2018. Robert Carter, London.
Thank you. A big conference was held in the Gaza Strip to mark the anniversary of an arson attack on the Al-Aqsa Mosque in 1969. 53 years ago, the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds was set on fire by an Australian Zionist named Dennis Michael Rohan in coordination with Israeli officials and military forces. Hundreds of people attended the national conference, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warned the Tel Aviv regime against crossing the red lines at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
We warn the Zionist enemy against making any stupid moves towards the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. We're willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We call on all Arab leaders to boycott the Israeli regime because it poses a great threat to all nations.
Soon after the arson attack, the Israeli regime increased the Judaization and settlement building in Al-Quds. Palestinian officials accused Arab regimes normalizing ties with Tel Aviv of encouraging Israeli attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The shameful normalization of ties between Arab countries and the Israeli regime is encouraging our enemy to carry out further attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Arab governments must stop encouraging the Israeli regime to violate the rights of the Palestinian people and their sacred sites. Al-Quds is the core of the Palestinian struggle.
This year's anniversary comes amid an escalation of Israeli attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Al-Quds is sacred to all Muslims and Palestinians who consider it as the capital of their future state.
Al-Quds will always be in the heart of the Islamic nation, and all attempts by the Israeli regime to change its status are doomed to fail. On this sad occasion, we call on all Arabs and Muslims to support Al-Quds and to support Palestine.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the heart of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice.
Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians in Al-Quds and turned a blind eye to Israeli violations against the Al-Aqsa Mosque for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A timeless beauty that tells stories from Iran's rich artistic heritage. Persian carpets are on display in the 29th Iranian Handwoven Carpet Show in Tehran. The event has brought under one roof producers of hand-woven carpets and pictorial rugs from across the country to showcase their latest designs.
The Persian carpet represents the identity of Iranians. Today, you can see machine-made carpets which are significantly lower in quality compared to the hand-woven ones. So this expo helps reintroduce the importance of hand-woven rugs to the people.
For centuries, the Iranian carpet has represented Iran's culture and art. Its unique design and quality have turned the ancient handicraft into a lucrative commodity on the global stage.
Less than three decades ago, this sublime art used to be a major export earner for Iran, a viable source of income that accounted for almost one-fifth of the country's non-oil revenues. But today, this is no longer the case, as producers are warning that the Iranian carpet is losing its shine in the global market.
From an annual revenue of up to $1 billion in the 1990s, the export of Iranian carpets has slumped to almost zero. One reason behind this freefall has to do with U.S. sanctions, says carpet trader who used to export to Europe before Washington's anti-Iran measures tightened the screw on the Persian carpet.
In the wake of the sanctions, it's safe to say that our carpet exports have dropped to almost zero. Complications in money transfer are one of the impacts of the sanctions, and the unwillingness of foreign clients to buy from us is the other result, because they fear U.S. punishment if they interact with us.
In 2018, another challenge came into play to knock the Persian carpet out of the global market once and for all. Surprisingly, it's a domestic issue. Since the depreciation of the Iranian rial, the government has imposed tight controls on currency liquidity, which require exporters to return their hard currency proceeds to the country within a very short period of time.
The government is not helping us, yet it's been creating problems for us by the so-called currency treaty. It's impossible to return the proceeds within only 2 months. We need time to sell our carpets in foreign countries where demand for our hand-woven carpets has declined.
The absence of genuine Iranian carpets in the international market has given way to other rivals to fill the void. Countries such as India, Pakistan, and even Afghanistan have since been supplying the market with cheap and fake copies of Iranian carpets, says this young carpet trader.
India, Afghanistan, Pakistan, they're just representing their tableau rugs and carpets with lower prices. The density of their carpets are lower than Iranian carpets, the colors. And also, if you just use them in your houses, you can see that their colors are faded by passing the time.
Representing Iran's heritage and civilization for thousands of years, the Persian carpet has for the past two decades disappeared from many floors and walls. Producers hope that this exhibition would act as a wake-up call for Iranian authorities to take action and dust off all the challenges from the Persian carpet. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yemeni officials criticize world bodies for lack of transparency in their humanitarian work in the conflict-stricken country. Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a on the occasion of the World Humanitarian Day.
The United Nations is in a state of weakness because it's subject to the conditions and dictates of donors, as it does not have its own resources. The United Nations has never proven its integrity despite receiving huge funds. If the UN is to be effective and impartial, it must have its own resources and grant everyone access to its financial reports, especially those who are receiving aid from the world body.
The ministry says world bodies must publicize their financial reports to prove their integrity. It says those world bodies receive billions of dollars every year from donors to save the lives of millions of Yemenis, but they're not doing much in this regard.
On World Humanitarian Day, we call on international organizations, including the UN, to increase transparency and integrity in their humanitarian activities in Yemen. Considering that many Yemenis have not seen the impact of their work and aid, there is massive corruption in international organizations, and therefore they must disclose their financial reports and explain to everyone how they spend what they get from donors.
Recently, the World Food Program said the cost of the minimum food basket has increased by 74%, and the prices of fuel have doubled across the country. The organization says this will push food insecurity in Yemen to new levels.
Yemenis believe that world bodies, including the United Nations, want the war in Yemen be prolonged so they can ask for more funds for their programs. They say that international bodies have failed to ease the humanitarian situation in their country, despite the fact that they received huge funds to aid Yemen during 7 years of war and siege.
Brazil's presidential frontrunner has pledged to tackle hunger and ensure food security as the country has returned to the United Nations hunger map as a result of the neoliberal policies of his opponent, incumbent Jair Bolsonaro. Former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva says there's no explanation for the dire circumstances within the country.
This has to end because there are 33 million people without enough to eat. There are 105 million people who are suffering from food insecurity. And this country is the third largest food producer in the world. It's the first animal protein producer in the world. There are no reasonable explanation.
Lula da Silva was joined at his first major rally in Brazil's largest city by several towering political figures of the Brazilian left, including former President Dilma Rousseff.
Few days remain for the election, and we're going to have to go out onto the street and convince each and every person for their vote, because right now, voting is the only weapon we have. It's the democratic weapon.
Lula is counting on the support of some of the largest unions and social movements on the continent, whose leaders have vowed to return the Workers' Party to the government.
Right now, 60 million children will go to sleep not knowing if they will have food tomorrow and next week. We live in a country that won't take care of the country's greatest asset, which is its people. A government that doesn't take of its greatest patrimony of human beings is a worthless government.
All polls show former President Lula with a significant margin, over Jair Bolsonaro, and Lula is continuing to gain ground and enjoys a higher level of support than the sum of all other candidates combined.
From here, we expect to see Lula embark on a Brazil-wide tour and meet with a range of sectors from which he seeks to lock down support. Camila Escalante from Sao Paulo.
The UK's biggest opposition party has entered into a membership crisis as close to 100,000 members abandoned the party over the past 12 months. On Tuesday, the Electoral Commission revealed that the UK Labour Party's membership fell by more than 91,000 in 2021, with a loss of income from membership fees contributing towards the party's end-of-year financial deficit of £5 million.
The question is, why is there a mass exodus of the Labour Party happening now, especially given the fact that over the past 12 months, it's been the ruling Conservative Party who have been embroiled in the majority of the headline-grabbing scandals? Well, speaking to Press TV, many former Labour members have informed us that it appears to be the direction in which the current leader, Keir Starmer, is taking the party in, which is proving to be a decisive factor for many.
Speaking to a former Labour member, shocking accusations of racism, Islamophobia and a purge of left-wing socialists has left a bitter taste with former Labour loyalists.
It's a witch hunt. There's actually been a witch hunt, and I firmly believe that currently in the Labour Party, they are actively on a witch hunt to wean out anyone who is not in line with their party. The leadership is taking the party down a route of racism, down a route of pure and utter Islamophobia. They're not only losing the minority vote, but they're losing many other people as well.
Labour's membership increased significantly during former party leader Jeremy Corbyn's term, swelling to more than 500,000. The lifelong socialist eventually handed over power following years of stiff rebellions from right-wing Labour MPs, who now head the party. The latest figures raise serious doubts of whether current leader Keir Starmer could win an election when he can't even win the hearts of Labour's own membership. Robert Carter, London.
The Biden administration says it doesn't share the Zionist regime's position on criminalizing six Palestinian NGOs, but also won't criticize the Israeli regime following a military raid on the organizations. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Michael Aria Ryder. This article is published under the heading Biden administration offers concern but refuses to condemn Israeli regime raids. Here's more. On August 18th, the Zionist regime forces carried out an overnight raid on the offices of seven Palestinian civil society organizations in the occupied West Bank. Armed troops stole documents, damaged property, and welded the office doors shut. Six of the seven targeted groups, including Al-Haq, Al-Dhamir, Defense for Children International, Palestine, the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, the Bissan Center for Research and Development, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, had been designated as terrorist organizations by the fake regime of Israel in October 2021. The Zionist regime has never provided any public evidence to back up these allegations, and classified documents obtained by Plus 972, Local Call, and The Intercept show that the accusations are dubious. Shortly after the Zionist regime designated the groups as terrorists, they presented the Biden administration with what they claimed to be unequivocal intelligence against Palestinian NGOs, State Department spokesperson of the U.S. Ned Price told reporters at the time, "We received detailed information from Israel. We appreciated the consultation. We are reviewing the information that they provided us." That was 10 months ago, but the Biden administration has still not made a public conclusion about the evidence. At an April 2022 State Department briefing, Price reiterated the same sentiment from October and did not indicate that they were any closer to reaching a verdict. At the briefing, Price was hit with a barrage of questions from the AP's Matt Lee and Al Quds' Saeed Aragat about the raids. Price expressed concern about the raids and said the administration was awaiting information about situation from its Israeli regime counterparts. The reporters asked why it hadn't released a statement about the evidence from October and why people should expect them to assess any new evidence in a timely manner. Lee told Price that the administration seemed to be in a perpetual state of limbo. "We have not seen anything that has caused us to change our position," Price eventually admitted, which marks the first time that the administration has acknowledged that it doesn't share the Zionist regime's position on this issue. However, Price refused to disagree with the Zionist regime directly, much less accuse them of lying. "So you don't believe the Israelis' information?" asked Lee at one point. "Intelligence information is always information that is the subject of analysis, and different parties can read information differently," responded Price, adding, "they can perceive of threats differently. Our own analysis heretofore of information that was provided last year has not caused us to change our approach to these organizations," unquote. When Price was asked why the administration is simply voicing concern instead of condemning the raids, he curiously referenced October evidence, saying, "I think the fact is that our Israeli partners took an action to designate these organizations as so-called terrorist organizations," said Price, adding, "What we have seen publicly, what they have conveyed privately in recent hours, is that there is an appropriate basis for the actions that they have taken. It will be a matter of urgency for us to review the basis for that information," he claimed. On Twitter, some pointed out that the Biden administration helped facilitate the raids via their inaction in regards to the original intelligence. To be clear, while this is the further U.S. government has come, it still falls very short of where it needs to be, wrote the Palestinian-American political analyst Yusuf Munayyer, adding, "Their equivocation for months emboldened the Israeli regime to raid these offices today. When will the U.S. finally condemn these actions? How much further does Israel have to go?" "The Biden administration has had Israel's evidence for almost a year," wrote Foundation for Middle East Peace President Lara Friedman, adding, "It clearly knows this evidence is BS. Otherwise, there is zero doubt they would have validated Israel's designated the groups themselves, but knowing the evidence was BS. They appear to have taken the politically and morally cowardly approach of staying silent, an approach that amounts to foreign policy gross negligence and complicity." She continued, "Make no mistake, this is gun situation. Israel put the gun on the table last October. The Biden administration saw that gun and decided to do nothing to pressure Israel to remove it. Now the Biden administration cannot claim surprise. When Israel aims and fires that gun at the Palestinian human rights defenders." A few Democratic House members also called Biden to act. I am upset by the latest attacks by the Israeli army on Palestinian human rights groups, tweeted Representative Andre Carson, adding, silencing human rights defenders is an attempt to avoid accountability. I reiterate calls from myself and my colleagues that the Biden administration immediately condemn this repression. Also, Representative Betty McCollum said, once again, the IDF has launched a chilling attack on Defense for Children International Palestine, a human rights organization supporting Palestinian children. The Biden administration must condemn these efforts to silence groups advocating for Palestinian human rights and civil society. Last year, McCollum introduced a resolution calling on the U.S. administration to condemn the Zionist regime's authoritarian and anti-democratic repression of the human rights groups.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Against Ukraine continues. This is while the U.S. military support also continues unabated, with the latest support equaling almost another $1 billion. Meanwhile, sanctions and condemnations against Russia have never stopped. For example, the U.K. has stated that Russia has no moral right to sit at the group of 20 nations. In this edition of The Spotlight, we'll look at where things stand, especially when it comes to the battered European economies, many facing energy shortfalls, or majority of them, coming before the upcoming winter season ahead. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. From the International Action Center, Sarah Flounders joins us from New York. Also joining us is contributor at the Schiller Institute, Karel Berys-Ken, who joins us from Paris.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Sarah Flounders, let me first start with you. Trying to keep up with the pace, let alone the numbers, in terms of the dollar amount from the U.S. in the form of military support for Ukraine. Another one, $775 million, $9 billion since the conflict began, and it's part of a huge $40 or $50 billion military package. What do you make of this massive military support that the U.S. is sending, which is said to be a largest arms transfer in U.S. history by some accounts?
Is this to me?
Yes, Sarah Flounders.
Well, it is an enormous, enormous subsidy to U.S. arms manufacturers. That's what it is, first and foremost. It's not meant in any defense of the people of Ukraine who are being used as pawns in a proxy war. And it is devastating for them. It's also devastating right back here. But it is a U.S. instigated effort to recap their hegemony in the world, which is rapidly fading. And so they are willing to pump billions and billions of dollars, which are payments, as I say, to the military industries here at great profit, and ship some of it. A lot of it just gets lost, resold, repackaged, but some of it gets shipped to the Ukraine. And at the same time, it is creating enormous economic hardship in Europe, because the sanctions, which go right along with the weapons packages, are devastating throughout the world. And it's meant to create hardship, but that is what the U.S. is willing to do in an effort to recapture its position.
Well, let's talk a little bit, Carell, if we can, about what the U.S. has sent in this latest batch. And I'm particularly zooming in on these launchers by the name of HIMARS, which are not the typical, launch vehicles that were used prior, but now recently the U.S. has actually sent it as part of their military package, 16 to be the latest batch, because the U.S. has actually limited that number, fearing that it's going to maybe lead to the U.S. endangering its own national security. It's pretty astounding that the U.S. is going to such limits to provide Ukraine with military assistance, isn't it, when it's looking at equipment that may actually endanger U.S.'s own national security?
Well, it does, because many wars, world wars, can also start very easily by errors of evaluation. And, of course, the French Caesar cannons are already a problem, although their reach is a little bit shorter. The HIMARS, and also the especially because they imply a lot of intelligence and assistance with radar equipment, and they're in reality, according to certain sources, there have been already strikes of by these weapon system on Russian territory itself, and then also in Crimea, which Ukraine will still pretend it is part of Ukraine, while in reality Crimea has decided to join the Russian Federation. So it is an escalation towards making Russia and also Europe co-belligerent actors in the war. And it is only the cold blood the calculation of the Russian military, which so far has kept things on a low level. Also, the HIMARS was used to eliminate the about 100 or at least half of the 100 arrested military forces of the Azov Brigade, which were in a special prison, and which, of course, were not eliminated by the Russians themselves, because they were set to speak before the tribunal and to tell what really happened. And they most probably, most likely, were eliminated with a strike from a missile to prevent them from speaking up.
All right. There's something that's really, I'm not too sure what to make of it. I'm going to call it, in a sense, shocking, Sarah Flounders, that came from the Pentagon. And I'd like to find out if you can make this out. The Pentagon has come out within the same setting, saying that right now There, according to the statement, a complete and total lack of progress has been made by the Russians on the battlefield. But then the same organization and the person from the Pentagon has said, when pressed by the reporters, that the Ukrainians lacked sufficient troops and combat power to drive the Russians from their defensive positions. This is in complete contradiction and contrast to the stance that the Pentagon has claimed within one setting. What do you make of it?
Well, I think I would make the same thing. Were the statements any different on Afghanistan right until the day before the U.S. was driven out? They were winning. They claimed it again and again in every public relations statement, and they demanded that Afghan officials also say the situation is being reversed. Didn't mean that it was. And so we've always seen this declaration of victory being just around the corner when, in fact, that's not what's happening. And as long as they can sell the weapons, pump the weapons in, as far as they are concerned, they're winning. They must find wars in order to make the super profits that the military industries are really built on. And they must justify the wars. So that really becomes a self-perpetuating claim. And it is very difficult to know what's actually happening from anything in the U.S. media, because they intentionally don't explain the reason for the war and what's happening on the ground. And at the same time, they claim to care a great deal about the people of the Ukraine. They really are into totally using the people of the Ukraine and organizing and funding for years fascist or Nazi forces in the Ukraine.
Karel, if I can ask you about this, it's almost the same question, but when we look at the numbers and the different analysis on Ukraine's military might, there seems to be a consensus on the fact that there's not enough manpower to defend Ukraine or to even be offensive against Russia, but that Ukraine needs equipment. The president has said that. So this kind of puts the focus on the equipment side of things. But we're talking about nuclear-powered Russia. The president has said, Vladimir Putin, nuclear weapons will not be used. But if pressed, and especially if they're looking after Crimea in what's supposed to be this big counteroffensive, do you think there's a possibility that that risks Russia using nuclear weapons of some kind?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball to... to really predict that this will happen or not. It is, in reality, what Sarah Flanders is saying is true. We're all being lied already on the initial strategy of Russia. Russia never intended to, and that's why they say it's a military operations, because in reality they don't want to invade the entirety of Ukraine and occupy it forever. You know, that's not absolutely not their aim. Secondly, according to the best estimates from the French military and U.S. military, it's there are three times more Ukrainian soldiers than Russian soldiers. So it's a pure lie to say that in terms of numbers, Ukrainians have much more people, which they are very badly trained and low qualified, but they have more people. That's true. And Russia is just taking time to let things work out and is expecting that at one point or another it will be very simply things will run out. And there is an inside division in the U.S., as we have seen with the declaration of Henry Kissinger, which is not my favorite at all, but who is somehow a realist, including a realist for U.S. strategic interests, where he said, you know, that Biden administration is bringing the U.S. in a war with Russia and China into things which the U.S. has partly played on, but nobody knows how this is going to end. So even people like Kissinger, which are not real humanists, you know, are afraid that this whole thing could go out of control and that at one point or another Yesterday there was a call by former U.S. military. There was the most lunatic elements, which were calling for increased weaponry and increasing, it's not only the quantity, but increasingly more offensive weapons. And that will at one point be used directly against Belarus and Russia. And at that point, then, of course, indeed, Russia could use nuclear strike as an answer. So we're sleepwalking into a big conflict if there is no wake-up call to get this thing under control.
Our guest talks about how things are getting to the point where it's out of control, Sarah Flounders. But aren't things out of control right now when you're looking at, for example, incidents concerns Germany, where Gazprom has again announced another halt to its gas flow to Germany? Reports of Germany being deindustrialized and that they need to ration electricity. I mean, that to me sounds like things have gotten out of control just on one European country. What do you think?
Things are certainly out of control within the European economy, Britain also. They're feeling the impact of the sanctions that have boomeranged back on them. It's also hitting here. Not as sharply right now, but we're feeling it also. Russia, who is self-sufficient in grain, in energy, in cereals, and a lot of resources, and a great deal of industrial infrastructure, is able to survive these very harsh sanctions and is setting up new banking transactions with other countries. On the other hand, the European Union suddenly finds itself without energy that they absolutely need to fuel their industries and homes and heating and air conditioning and everything that you need in summer and winter. And every single country is feeling the shortages with crazy messages to the populations to shower less and turn out your lights and so on. This won't solve the problems in Europe, but it really means that the sanctions are coming back and hitting them hard because they don't have an alternative to the gas and the oil that they previously exported and used in great quantity and at great advantageous to their own industries. And this is what the U.S. wants to break, because there was 10 times more trade, for example, between Germany and Russia than with the U.S. Well, they want to reverse that and close the door on trade with Russia. It is devastating for the German economy and most of the other countries in Europe that are going along with the sanctions.
Still don't understand how this can actually happen, Corral, when we take a look at the fact that there's still European countries that are purchasing gas and oil from Russia. Germany is still doing that. The Netherlands is still doing that. There are many others that are still doing that with that scheme of how they need to, exchange the euros into rubles and deposit it in one of the Russian banks, Gazprom, I believe. So, you know, that doesn't go with the way that the EU is promoting its all-out sanctions war with Russia. What do you make of that?
Well, it reveals the completely hypocritical system which this EU has become, because they are facing, officially they want to have an embargo, but in practice it will take months and years, and even then, you know, we have, there's a lot of oil bought from India, which is shipped somewhere else, and then it ends up even back in the United States, you know. So the whole facade of things, I mean, this is the craziness of things. They decide things which are absolutely impossible to put into practice, and because they, for example, Renault, you know, the French car industry, they sold their assets for for a symbolical sum of money, sold it to the Russians, and then but they have a special deal that they can buy it back for the same price in the next 6 years, because they expect at that point, you know, maybe the war will be ended and things could be back to normal. So there is, but there is a real clash between the political elites, which are completely insane, and the other on the side, the real people and the economic interests, even the, which are really in shock. And also because the sanctions will not only hit Europe, but a lot of countries to which Europe, if you take, for example, Cambodia, you know, they buy 60%. If they have to apply the sanctions, you know, this will completely screw up supply lines for the entire Western economy. So it's, and I'm not even speaking about the food riots, which can happen any day at this point.
August 18, 2022, Sarah Flanders, Diplomacy Watch. Talks to end the war are back on the agenda. This is what one of the headline reads, confirmed by some other ones. However, actions speak louder than words. When you hear about the $785 million of weaponry that the U.S. sold, doesn't sound like diplomacy is back on the agenda or on the table. But in the bigger picture, 6 months, how much diplomacy was on that scale on the left, and how much military talk of war was on the other side of the scale? Why isn't there such a push for a diplomatic solution to this conflict, do you think?
Well, frankly, the U.S. is not interested in a diplomatic solution anywhere in the world. And every treaty, every agreement they have ever made, they have violated. This is true whether it's Iran or Russia or China or the indigenous nations of the U.S. or the countries of Latin America. They do use diplomacy from time to time, but only in terms of aggressively planning the next wars. And their interest, their bottom line interest, is in using their military and economic power to maintain their world domination. That is what is slipping, because countries around the world have reached a certain industrial and technical capacity to trade and exchange with each other. That is a big change. Before this, the dollar was all powerful, and there was no way, once you were cut off from the SWIFT banking, to do some of the simplest transactions. But now, countries have found there's all forms of digital currency. In China with the SWIFT, the CIPS, in Russia with the SPSF, there's mere credit cards. There's all kinds of ways that countries are finding to arrange exchanges for the resources that they need outside of the sanctions that are being imposed by the U.S. as an effort to shut this down. They want each country on their own to starve. That is the purpose of sanctions, is to inflict the greatest pain on the civilian population. And countries are finding ways to survive, to exchange, to trade with each other.